Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. July 13th, 2023, The World is Burning edition. I'm David Plotz of CityCast in a toasty but not intolerable Washington, D.C. I'm joined, of course, by John Dickerson of CBS Primetime from New York City. Hello, John. We're both back. Were you on vacation? I was on vacation. I don't know if you were on vacation last week.
No, I wasn't on vacation, but since you and Emily were on vacation, I was a free-floating amoeba in the world.
That was a long horn.
You hear that's New York City outside. That's how we resolve our differences when it's hot. Is just lean on the horn.
Exactly.
It's a nice teaser for later on.
That other voice you heard is first time host Maren Kogan. Maren is senior correspondent at Vox, where she covers a lot of things, but especially transportation. And Maren, you may remember, was part of our favorite segment of 2022 when we talked about her piece about Strode's. And so we thought, given that Emily is still out, we would have her back for the whole show and hit some of her favorite topics today. Hello, Maren. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I was just going to say, I hope it's not going to be the last time.
We shall see. I don't know. I hate to make predictions.
See how bad I messed this up.
This week on the Gabfest, the heat wave across the South, the brutal rainstorms in New England, smoke everywhere. How can we live with this more extreme, more dangerous, more erratic climate that we have inflicted on ourselves? Then Twitter has been the central platform for American political conversation for almost a generation. Is Threads going to unseat it? Would that be a good thing? Is Twitter going to survive the assault from Threads? Then Maren has an important and kind of worrying new article in Vox about car ownership, which has become a key tool for getting into the middle class, but has become more and more expensive and precarious. We will talk about whether it should be a right. Should Americans have the right to own a car? Plus, of course, we'll have cocktail chatter.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
July 4th was the hottest day in Earth's recorded history. There's a heat dome across the Southwest that is bringing unbreakable temperatures of 110 degrees plus throughout that region. Death Valley is about to have the hottest recorded moment ever in the history of the globe. Texas and the Southeast are experiencing heat and humidity that have pushed wet bulb temperatures above the limits of human tolerance. So have countries like Pakistan and other countries in Asia. Water off the coast of Florida, ocean water, is more than 90 degrees. It's a hot tub ocean. There's smoke everywhere. There are heat waves in Europe, 100-year rainfall events in Japan and India, not to mention the catastrophic rain and flooding in Vermont. And remember, as people like to point out, this is probably one of the coolest summers of the rest of your life. John, how are we going to survive this?
We're going to paint everything in that white paint. There was a story about it that's been produced at Purdue. The Times had a story about it this week. If you paint with this white paint, which is the whitest paint known to man, whiter even than me, if you paint a building with it, it cools the temperature of the building by 9 degrees and 19 degrees at night. So that's going to solve everything. It's not going to solve everything, but it was one tiny hopeful fact. It has some slight downsides too, which
you're distracting. Like, engage with the question.
I'm trying not to start off on an incredibly downer note, because also June was recorded to be the hottest month ever. One in three Americans are under some kind of heat threat. It's just awful. 2023 is likely to be the hottest year on record, and as you said, it's only going to get worse. So I don't know how it's going to get better.
The fact that we're getting excited about white paint, I think, is a sign that we're in serious trouble. I don't know. I personally, I hope that this is the wake-up call we finally... I mean, how many times are we going to say that, right? But it feels like the things that climate scientists have been warning us about for years are here, and it feels very visceral, I think, for millions of people. So I'm hopeful that this sparks some serious action finally, and people can come together and do something about this.
To the white paint point, Maren, like, we've clearly lost the war on emissions, right? That emissions continue, CO2 emissions continue, the destruction that is accelerating, the heating of the planet continues. You know, there will be, it may not be the worst case scenario, but it's obviously the planet is getting hotter and it's getting more erratic in its weather and more dangerous. That is definitely happening. And one of the reasons we failed to stop this is that it got very politicized, that the idea of the planet heating became a political issue and there was not political will to deal with it. There's now going to be a push for mitigation measures. White paint is a mitigation measure. Can mitigation be nonpartisan? Can mitigation become a cause that is a human cause, not a political cause, and that the world can come together on ways to make life less unpleasant for us?
Well, I think the mitigation is a safer place than on the causal end. Like, if you look at where the problem is happening, it's happening in a lot of red states, which are getting redder by the day as they get warmer. So something has to be done. Arizona is a potentially, now has a Democratic governor. But if you look at what's happening in Phoenix, I mean, you read the stories about the heat in Phoenix, and the number of deaths, particularly the homeless population and the poorest in Phoenix, it's just grisly. It feels like you're reading the stories of Arrakis, like 100 years before, you know, they had to go around capturing sweat and because that was the only water that was left.
But I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that you mentioned the homeless. I was talking to a friend of mine who lives in that area yesterday, and he was like, "Oh, it's fine." Like, he just sits in his air conditioning. And like, one of the things I worry about is that this is, like so many things, this is a crisis for poorer people, a crisis for people who are less resourced, but that the people who are decision makers, I don't think that any member of Congress is going without air conditioning. Have you been on, I mean, the Capitol is one of the coldest places on earth because they air condition that place so well. And I just worry that this idea that this could be a wake-up call isn't really there, because it's not punishing all of us. It's only punishing a fraction of people.
But it is punishing their constituents. So that's been, I think, the 12th straight day of 110 degree temperatures in Phoenix. Phoenix in the 1900s had 5 days where the average temperatures were 110 or higher. It's now 27 days, an average of 27 days a year. That's affecting the people who live there. The number of death toll in Phoenix is up 25% over the previous year as a result of heat. I mean, when your constituents are dying, and it's not just the homeless, it's the elderly, like when the bodies are piling up and the businesses are having to pay more to air condition, and there is this, you know, there are costs associated back home. And also, by the way, this is something for governors to deal with. When power grids are crumbling, that is a, you know, those are real effects that affect governors, and that might change. Again, to your original question, which I think was a smart one, which is like, how do we deal with the fact it's hot? Forget about what caused it for the moment. How do we deal with the fact that it is hot is a safer political place? Although, to Maren's point, all the places we thought were safe for politics, because when you look at some of the mitigation measures to save water with faucets or to change light bulbs, those have become politicized. So as I say this, I slightly take it back. But on the other hand, if all your citizens are baking, perhaps that changes things.
Well, some of them aren't baking, Maren. Some of them are also drowning. So I wonder, you write a lot about transportation, which is writing about infrastructure. And one of the things that we see with all of the climate chaos is that infrastructure is under this incredible stress. Like, places are, when you have flooding that tears a town apart, it just causes huge amounts of damage. Fires destroy infrastructure, destroy places where people live and work and recreate and so forth. I worry we can't keep up with it. it's one thing to recover from a single hurricane and have 5 years to recover from it. It's another when there's a hurricane, then there's smoke, then there's fire, then there's a flood, then there's a heat wave, and it's happening everywhere. And the country will not have the resources to keep up with this, and the world won't.
I think that's absolutely right. It's going to pose these huge, huge infrastructure challenges. I think that we're not keeping up with the infrastructure challenges that we have now. There's so much crumbling infrastructure in this country. This is going to expose so many weak points. And I think the lesson I took away from reading everything is that we're not ready at all for this. Like, none of us are ready. There was some money, I think, in the infrastructure bill to help sort of prepare for the climate future that we're going to see, the near future that we're going to see, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be enough. Just to go back, so there are the sort of obvious manifestations of climate change. When we talk about the infrastructure, we see these dams that are near breaking. We see bridges being washed away. We see train tracks being washed away. Those are going to be really obvious physical signs that may spark action. I do really worry, to John's point about the heat thing, because, you know, heat, I was reading, causes more deaths than any other weather event in the country, which was sort of surprising to me because it's a little bit less visible, right? And he's right that people, you know, people in the U.S., the people who don't have air conditioning are, you know, disproportionately elderly, they may be low income. I'm thinking of the comparison with Europe, where, you know, only something like 10% of homes are air conditioned there. And I read that 60,000 people died from heat waves last summer. That is an astonishing figure. And I do really worry that, you know, the rise in the homeless and houseless population in this country over the last few years, combined with these extreme weather events, is that we're going to see more of these deaths. And I would hope that that would inspire some action. I think I've learned to never make strong predictions when it comes to politics, because that's the most surefire way to make a fool of yourself. But I would hope that that would at least inspire some people to take this very seriously as an issue.
I think there's about two things. I worry about all of it, I suppose. But two things that really get to me. One is when you're talking about all the heat deaths. Those heat deaths, in some sense, are invisible. Like, they didn't discover that 61,000 people died in 2022, they discovered in 2023 when they went back and looked and realized, oh, we have this excess of deaths. What explains this excess of death? It's that, like, people were overtaxed and they had heart conditions and they died because you could attribute this to excess heat. But it's not in the moment. You're not like, oh, this person was killed by heat. So one thing that concerns me is a lot of the pain is invisible and people kind of attribute it to something else and only later realize, oh no, it was this. And the other thing is, just to this infrastructure point, is where John and I don't know about you, Maren, but John and I lived through the 70s. And one of the things that was notable at the 70s is that there are places that just started to seem disordered that had been ordered before, and cities felt disordered. And the one reason they felt disordered is that the cities were unable to kind of keep up with the basic habits and necessities of making life tolerable for people. So you'd have garbage piling up, you'd have potholes that were too big, you'd have just abandoned buildings. And that just made places feel bad and chaotic and unsafe. And that caused sort of economic decline. And I worry that on a kind of global scale, that's what we're going to get. We're going to get an inability to keep up with the basic maintenance of infrastructure that you need for people to feel they are living in a tolerable place. And that will just make life feel worse as well as be worse. Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the Gabfest, on other Slate podcasts. You get bonus episodes of some Slate podcasts. You get ad-free Slate podcasts. And our Slate Plus segment is one we're really excited about. We've been flattering Maren so much already, but I'm going to flatter her. So one of the other things she's been writing about and has been thinking about is the paradox of traffic enforcement, where we have too much enforcement against poor people, which causes all kinds of misery for them. But on the other hand, too little enforcement of a lot of traffic problems, which is contributing to traffic deaths, a sense of lawlessness in the streets. So how do we deal with the traffic enforcement paradox? And anyone who's ever seen someone run a red light or park in a bike lane or drive around with fake plates, if you've ever seen any of that and have been annoyed by it, this will be a segment for you. Go to slate.com/gabfestplus and become a member. This episode of the Gabfest is sponsored by Aura Frames. Are you ready to win Mother's Day? Cement your reputation as the best gift giver in your family. Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. That mom will love looking back on childhood memories, seeing you what you're up to today, checking out grandkids, checking out cousins. And even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep on updating your mom's frame with new photos so that it's a gift that keeps on giving. This is how I live in my family. I gave my mother an Aura frame. It was either for Mother's Day or for her birthday. She absolutely adores it. She's constantly hectoring me to update it with more photos, which I do. I also gave my girlfriend's mother an Aura frame, and I hope she hectors my girlfriend to update it with more photos. But it is a present that will bring absolute delight to a mother in your life. And they have a great deal for Mother's Day. Gabfest listeners can save on this perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
John Dickerson, I'm so interested in your thoughts on this coming topic. So Threads has arrived. Threads is a spear hurled by Mark Zuckerberg with his newly massive pecs right at the heart of Elon Musk and Twitter. The fastest growing app in history, Threads has attracted more than 100 million users in a couple of weeks. It's a kind of lightweight ripoff of Twitter mediated through Instagram. With Elon Musk just thrashing and beating and punishing Twitter and alienating longtime users such as, say, John Dickerson and David Plotz, and making the platform way worse, Meta saw the opportunity to steal from Twitter the role of the place of public conversation, the town square for really loud people. And it's made huge headlines. It's shaken things up. So John, you were one of the OGs of Twitter. You've been there. You have an enormous following. You've used it with such joy and success over decades. And now I'm really interested in your thoughts on Threads and your thoughts on how it could shape or not shape what political discourse is like.
Well, Threads at the moment feels like Twitter did back in not exactly 2007 when I started, but in the early days, which is less toxic, less consumed by the extremely online, more fun. If there are political conversations, they are more like conversations. They are not immediate motive questioning and bad faith throwing of chum into the water. It just feels like a more pleasant place to be. This doesn't mean that we don't need to pay a lot of attention to what Meta may be up to, either A, in terms of scraping all of our data for AI purposes, or the privacy concerns. When you sign up for Threads, it knows what phone you have, what model, when you did it, where you are, that kind of thing.
So, I don't even know what phone I have. I literally don't know.
Right,
what
I know
kind
it would be
have.
Helpful.
they told me that would be great.
But it's not, and Twitter has been, toxifying and getting just worse and feeling more like the old fashioned checkout counter. In the old days when you were a kid and you'd walk through the checkout counter, you'd see like world news, Hillary Clinton has an alien baby. And you'd think like there's this one little 3 feet of humanity where just insanity, the National Enquirer, world news, it was like occupied by total madness. And that's kind of what Twitter's felt like for a long time. It's still got some useful, links, and that's a place where some news, but it's so far from what it used to be long ago. The question I have for Threads is whether it's basically just enjoying a little honeymoon here at the beginning, and then a lot of the forces that toxified Twitter, many of them are introduced by Elon Musk and the users, but Whether those kind of, because it's our politics and it reflects our politics, if that ends up being what happens on Threads, then it will infect Threads too. Although they're trying very hard not to make it the public political town square, which might be, if they can do that, the secret to its success.
So, Marin, are you on Threads? Are you a Twitter person?
I'm a complicated. Yeah, my relationship with Twitter is complicated, and I am on Threads, so I have lots of thoughts. I don't know. I'm really torn because Threads does not feel intuitive to me. Like, it's hard to use the feed. I don't know who I'm following. It's just like a bunch of random people posting selfies and like brands that I'm pretty sure I didn't follow. On the other hand, like, Twitter has been a cesspool for me for a really long time. Like, if you're a woman who is a journalist or any other sort of semi-public figure, being on Twitter, you have to be so careful about what you say. It's almost like not worth it to post anything beyond links to your stories because there are just tons of like bad faith. And I'm sure this is true for you guys too. I don't mean to exclude you, but like there are tons of people out there just like waiting to find the most bad faith read of whatever you post and to like repost it for clout. So it feels like this would be a good sort of alternative to that. On the other hand, I just don't understand how Threads works. I'm concerned about the privacy stuff. I will say the one thing that is giving me pause on making a sort of final judgment is that everyone else, like the people who aren't sickos like us, who've been on Twitter for over a decade, seem to really like it. And I think that speaks to the fact that maybe they've felt shut out of Twitter, or like Twitter is just way too hostile for them. So if we're creating a space for people to be able to share their voices, and I do love the idea of having a place where I can just post stupid thoughts.
Elon Musk is repellent. I mean, he's a repellent person. He certainly degraded Twitter for many of us who liked it. But in my view, he's unquestionably a better force in the world than Meta. That Meta, via Facebook and via WhatsApp, has been a primary architect for misinformation, for dictatorial thuggishness, for bullying, for the organization of wickedness in the digital world. And all of it coated in this syrupy, disgusting syrupy syrup of confection of fraudulent human connection, like that they always dress it up like, oh, we're here for human connection. It's like, yeah, you're here for human connection, but you're also enabling really terrible people to do things and encouraging them to do terrible things. I kind of feel like it would be tragic if Meta, which has done so much wrong to the world, also ended up taking over this space of public conversation. As much as I find Elon Musk like an unappealing character, it would to me be a bummer if Meta also now was the conglomerate of this too.
Yeah, I think that's right. I guess the other part of it that's disturbing to me, even as I sort of participated in it, is that there's just this, whenever something new drops, there's just this sort of unquestioning rush where we all download it on our phones, right? And then it's like, oh, the data privacy stuff seems bad, but like everyone's doing it, so like it must be okay, right? I mean, I felt this way about TikTok too. It's just, we need to develop a better critical framework as a society, I think, for rushing into these new products. And I guess it does speak to this clamoring people felt for something other than Twitter, but it's surprising that it would be so big. And probably, honestly, it's partly media inflated. Like, Twitter is a really big deal to people in our space, right? It's a really big deal to politicians, to journalists, to people who think about this stuff, but it's not such a big deal to everyone else. So I don't know, maybe the public was dying to have this sort of text-based app, and that's why we all rushed into it. But I do worry about the way we just unthinkingly download these things and sort of check off the agreement, you know, the terms of service agreement, and then give all our data away without thinking that much about it. I will say the other thing, and I hope I'm not changing the subject too much, is that I do really want to see where this cage match between Elon and Zuck goes.
Is that for real? Like, they're actually talking about doing this? It is. It's like a joke. It's like something out of a Idiocracy.
I was reading last night that UFC president Dana White has been on the phone with each of them every night for like a week, planning the details of this cage match, which makes me think that it is real. And I also think we should never underestimate the ability of a billionaire man to dramatically overestimate his capabilities in all things. So I think it could happen.
Oh my God.
And I would love to see it.
Oh my God.
One of the things I was reading referred to Mark Zuckerberg's own personal journey of fitness and general excessive manliness as he becomes skilled in various forms of martial arts. And I realize I need a personal journey. I'm concerned I'm not on a personal journey. His personal journey seems to have made him very, he's all glowing and he's out there grappling on squeaky mats in what seemed to me to be a bounty of joy for him.
Turbo John.
Right, exactly. I need a personal journey to kind of get me out of the attic. That's the thing. Maybe my personal journey needs to have more sunlight and I don't know. It just seemed like there's a lot of smiling that goes on in his personal journey. Can I keep stealing the mic, though, which is good to go back to this idea of Threads as a place for the public conversation. I'm just going to steal completely from Jill Lepore's book, These Truths, which doesn't address social media so much, but has a wonderful section on polling and the rise of polling and the mistaken idea that polls and just getting thousands of unfiltered opinions is in any way a replication of the town hall and is a beneficial place to have public political conversation. And her argument essentially is the town halls were mediated squares where, first of all, you had to show up, where any old rando, they could pop off, but there were kind of norms of the culture that that meant people who participated had to actually participate. You know, you couldn't just winging out theories wouldn't get you very far, that you had to really engage in. And engaging in meant treating the other side with at least with assuming good faith at the beginning. It meant a whole set of rules for debate and conversation that the current people who mistake social media for the town hall just totally forget.
But one of the despondent, demoralizing things that's happened in American public life is we actually do have a lot of real world public square now, too. And people say, oh, it's just the internet. People are trollish on the internet and there's assholes on Twitter. But then you look at what's happened in school board meetings across the country and in town meetings across the country, where there are these places where people are meant to gather and calmly deliberate and discuss the issues that their community faces. And those meetings have also degenerated into the same kind of vile spew that is all over our online life. So the hope that the real world could protect us from the online world, I think, is fading fast. In fact, the online world has infected the real world too.
I guess I was just tangling with the idea that this online is going to be the place where this kind of conversation could take place. And also, you've got to have politicians listen to that kind of conversation, and they're not. They're listening to the attention grabbing conversation, which is not deliberative.
Two questions to get us out of this, Maren. So if you look at the history of these hot new apps, if you think about Clubhouse or there was Google Plus, which was going to be a social network, a lot of times they don't survive. There are ones that do. TikTok has survived. Although TikTok wasn't a rocket ship. TikTok had a slow burn. It had a slow build. What makes you think that Threads will or will not last?
Honestly, I don't think we know. I think it's way too soon to say. I mean, certainly there was this big rush and everyone signed up for it. But remember when everyone signed up for Clubhouse? I mean, it didn't even, that felt like such a blip ultimately. So I think for Threads to stick around, it has to be good. It has to be intuitive to use. It has to be easy to use. It has to give people what they want. I think so far for me, it's not delivering on certain things. Like, it's harder to connect. There's no DM function. There's no search function. So those are the things that I think it would need to succeed. But again, I will say that like tons of people who have rushed onto it, who I think were not traditional Twitter users, seem to be loving it. So if they can find an audience in the people who were more traditionally on Instagram or Facebook, then it could do really well. But I do think it's like way too soon to call it a Twitter killer.
And John, actually, then the last question of that, which is just a flip side, is what could Twitter do to save itself now?
It's a great question. And then also, what is the question? So in other words, does Twitter want to have 100 million users the way Threads does? Or does Twitter want to become an intense place, smaller audience, but intense audience? It's definitely a smaller audience. 28% of their revenue has gone down. Or at the moment,
but they have way more than 100 million, by the way. I mean, Twitter has 250 million daily actives, I think.
But Meta has 2 billion and is on, I mean, it's at 100 million in a week. Fastest uptake of an app since ChatGPT, which is the fastest uptake of an app since ever. So it's on its way. I don't know. So I don't know, A, whether its goal is to be big and have everybody in the pool or have it just be a super intense place, and what's better for ads. It doesn't seem to be better. Its intensity has not been good for ads, 28% lower in ad revenue than last year, according to eMarketer. If they wanted to get better, I think there is, first of all, Maren's point is really great about how the unthinking rush into Threads. It's amazing. When people talk about the dangers of AI, they say, you know, we unthinkingly rushed into social media and we really should pause. So here we are in this hyper frenetic moment of pausing about AI, and the new social media thing comes along and suddenly everybody drops their trousers and goes running out into the street and is all like, it's just, we really have these appetites.
I will say Elon said, I think maybe this week or last week, oh, it's infinitely more preferable to get yelled at by a bunch of strangers on Twitter than the sort of hide it all pain of Instagram. And I was like, completely disagree, dude. Like, I would rather take the place where people are pretending that things are pleasant and nice than being yelled at by a bunch of strangers. Like, it's a no-brainer for me. So I question his sense of what people want.
Also, it seems to be a total admission of what Twitter has become. You know, it's like, I mean, I think you want to ixnay on the hellscape, you know, instead of saying, no, the hellscape is great because it's all paved. You know,
right? The weather is so warm down here. Exactly. It's wonderful.
Exactly. I like shorts anyway.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
the great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Marin covers transportation for Vox, among other things, and this has given her a front seat on some of the most fascinating, contentious issues in American public policy life. And as we discussed, her piece on the most dangerous street in America for pedestrians prompted the top GabFest conversation of 2022. She has a new piece out, The Impossible Paradox of Car Ownership. For many working class Americans, cars are a burden and a necessity. So, Marin, GabFest listeners, I think in public transit-rich cities may think of cars as a kind of stupid and egregious, but they are the most necessary possession of most American households. After shelter, the car is a requirement. You have the stat, which is that 92% or 91.3% of American households have a car, more than I'm sure have anything else, more than have broadband. The problem is that it's become harder to own them, right?
Yeah. And I will say sometimes in some of the conversations I've had, sometimes the car is even more important than the shelter, because in many cases, the car becomes the shelter, right? Certainly in the case of the woman that I was writing about, when she was really struggling, she was sleeping in her car. So yeah, I mean, there's a funny disconnect, you know, and if you live in a transit rich place, you know, you may see all the downsides of cars and think they're sort of an annoyance and they're expensive and whatever, but for most people living in most of the U.S., your car is essentially your ticket to being a fully functioning adult in the United States. It's your ticket to participating in American life. You can't get a good paying job without a car, usually, especially if you are working class or low income and you live far away from a city where the housing is affordable, right? You need a car to get to work, to get a good paying job, to get groceries, to get medical care, to move your family around. The car is everything. And I think, you know, that has always been true. And cars have always been expensive for people who don't have a ton of money, right? Like if you pretty much since the car was invented, it's going to eat up a decent portion of your budget. If you don't have a ton of money. But during the pandemic, when everyone sort of moved away from mass transit because there were concerns about being in closed spaces with people, the cars became even more important. They unfortunately became much, much more expensive. So when I talk about the impossible paradox of car ownership, and this is primarily for people who are working class and low income, the paradox is you can't really afford a car, but you can't afford not to have a car. And so sort of looking at the way prices have risen in the last 3 years and just how difficult it is for people to maintain their cars, hold on to their cars. And not just that, but it's not just the car. Like the car for many people is about their ability to survive in this country. So writing about the way that a car can play a huge role in whether or not you're doing well or not was sort of the point of this piece.
Can you give some chapter and verse on the costs and how they have become more expensive?
Absolutely. So new car prices themselves have risen so much that a new car, the average new car is about $48,000 right now. Now, the reason that is happening is because there's this global microchip shortage, right? And all the auto manufacturers, they used to make a lot of sort of affordable cars, smaller cars, more affordable, cars at different price points for a different range of buyers. Increasingly, because of this microchip shortage, because you make more profits when you build luxury cars, right? They're focusing on these big luxury SUVs, trucks, these nice big expensive cars. And so that's driven the average price of a new car up. So what's happened now is most people can't afford a new car, right? So they're turning to the used car market. So between, I think it was May 2020 and May 2023, the average price of a new car rose 25%. And that turned everyone onto the used car market, which drove demand way up. So now the average price of a used car between 2020 and 2023 rose 50%. So it's just kind of mind-boggling. And, you know, this is one of these things that it's sort of happening in all of our lives. And we all sort of vaguely know, like anyone who tried to buy a car in the last few years noticed the prices were really high. But I feel like unlike other things, we don't necessarily talk about this stuff because it is just considered so essential to how most people get around. It's like, it's almost too obvious to say that most people need a car to get around. But when you start to break down the numbers, I think it becomes much more striking.
Maren, do you think that the outrage over gas prices, which is there is always an outrage over gas prices, but the outrage a year ago when prices were at their height was really a debate or outrage about what this paradox you're talking about, that it got at this centrality of the car and the challenges you write about, but through gas prices, which obviously are connected to cars, but I don't know, did it have extra energy because of what you're talking about?
That's a great question. I would say the answer is probably yes and no. I mean, the gas prices thing is like a perennial political issue because it is something that affects everyone, right? And it's sort of easy to glom onto and blame whoever's in charge. And it's something that like will reliably upset people in the opposite party, right? So I think that part is always there. But I do think there was an undercurrent of the fact that it's not just gas prices, right? It's also insurance rates are higher than they've ever been. There are just so many different things that go with car ownership and the price of cars in general. So I think people were responding on some level to the fact that there's this sort of background noise of things getting more and more expensive. And certainly it's true beyond just cars, right? Food prices, so many other prices. But it's really striking the differences in price with cars right now. And I think that had to have played a part in it.
The premise of your piece in some ways, I guess I'm not saying it's an advocacy piece, but kind of the premise is we need to get cars into the hands of poor Americans. Like poorer Americans, working class Americans need to get cars. Does this mean that as citizens, we shouldn't root for more buses and trains? If everyone actually needs a car, should the investment in public transit be as significant as people like me want it to be?
I'm really happy you asked me this because part of my purpose in writing this, I've written a lot about why cars are bad. And this is sort of a counterbalance piece. I see it in some sort of ways, like actually cars are good for certain segments of the population. But it is true. There are some people who advocate for more cars for low income people. And there are a lot of critics of this idea. Like they think that, you know, cars are not the answer, obviously. And if you give cars to low income people, you're just reinforcing a system that disproportionately punishes poor and low income Americans anyway, right? Because there's still going to be people without cars who struggle. Cars are still going to be too expensive. You're not addressing the systemic problem. So what I would say is, no, it doesn't mean we shouldn't be pushing for better mass transit. We should be pushing for a system, and I think the top priority should be pushing for a system that is more sustainable and more affordable and gives people better options than having to get in their car everywhere, right? That would be better for all of us. And I think most of us could stand to drive less, right? But there is a segment of the population that if we deny car ownership to, we are essentially locking them out of the economy. And I think that we need to listen to people who are struggling about where they're at. They're in the system that we have now, not the sort of utopian transit future that we all want to see. We need to listen to them about what they need to survive. And we need to understand that we can, while most of us should be driving less, there are certain people whose lives can be majorly improved by having access, even just access to a car, and that will make their lives better. I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time on that.
I was struck. I mean, you've already made this point, Maren, but I was also struck by the way how analogous this is to the affordable housing debate, that the lack of a car has a lot of the same impacts on people's lives as the lack of steady housing. You drop further and further down the economic ladder. Your children are at risk. You have this precariousness. You have difficulty securing work. And this is true if you don't have stable housing. It's true if you don't have a stable access to a car. That's just it's not really a question. It's just like, it is interesting how analogous it is.
It's interesting to me, too. And I think a big part of why the car has become so necessary is that we've suburbanized poverty in this country, right? We're pushing people further and further and further out from city centers where there's good access to public transit. And just thinking about, you know, honestly, all of the things we're talking about today, you can see the threads connecting everything, right? Like people being pushed further out, not having as good of access to social services in cities, all the paved suburbs, right, that we've created that are contributing to climate change, the way low-income people have less access to air conditioning. Like all of these things are interconnected. And I think, I don't know, it's just really striking to me the way they all start to piece together. And that was a big thing with this piece is that, you know, On some level, I was talking to people about cars, which sounds, cars, it's like not the most exciting topic in the world. But I was really talking to them about what it means to survive. And so many of these people I spoke to, losing access to their car, having their car repossessed, it was tied in with some other major crisis in their life. Like they were leaving an abusive marriage and trying to start over with young kids, or they were struggling with addiction and entering rehab, or, you know, they were essentially homeless and only had the car, you know. So it's a car, but it's much bigger. It's what you need to survive here.
I'm just to close this. I mean, I'm sure you guys know the song Fast Car. I don't know if you've heard the Luke Combs. Luke Combs, this wonderful country singer, has just done a cover of the Tracy Chapman song Fast Car. It's so good. And it's just reminder what a wonderful song that is. But that song is your story. That song is about the possibility of a car offering economic opportunity, escape, like the chance to make it.
Remember when we were driving in your car, speed so fast it felt like I was drunk. City lights lay out before us, and your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling that I belonged. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone.
And, if you haven't listened to the Luke Combs cover, listen to it. It's gorgeous. Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are not about to get into your car, you're about to have a cocktail, so you are not about to get into your car. I was just in Scotland and was out and I was driving, which is terrifying to drive in Scotland on the wrong side of the road. But I had to check to see whether you were allowed to drink at all before you got into a car in Scotland because I was driving and I wanted to have like one drink. You can. But in general, you shouldn't drink before you get into a car.
You
John,
mean
what
blood
are you
alcohol, gathering? Blood alcohol yeah. level is zero. It has to be zero.
Yeah, does it? I was asking, and the waiter at the restaurant said it does not have to be zero.
Okay.
In Scotland. I don't know. He said this is not legal advice.
I was going to say, as long as you got it from an authority, as long as you got it from a
yes,
trusted
exactly.
authority, I think you're fine.
Let me go to the, let me ask the barman about whether having a drink is a good idea on the road. My
what's
cocktail
your chatter?
My cocktail chatter is... at our live show, I quoted Rich Lowry of the National Review writing in Politico about the dilemma facing the Republican Party. And he said basically that the challenge for Republicans is that they are growing more attached to a candidate who is going to be harder to elect, which is just kind of the short sentence way of thinking about what's happening in the Republican race. If you don't have time to think about it more than that, the Pew Research Center put out some data on the 2022 race, which ratifies this point. And it found two things. One, when you look at who voted in the last 2020 presidential election, 68% of those who voted in that election turned out in the midterms. And in that cohort, Trump's voters voted at a higher rate, 71%, than Joe Biden's voters, 67%. So intensity was on the side of the Republicans. So just like what's happening now, very intense attachment to a candidate. But that intensity of attachment to their own worldview had a downside, which is in the midterm elections, Democrats won independents by 2 points. Now, you wouldn't think 2 points, that's a huge victory. But when you are the party in power of the White House, usually you don't do so well in the midterms. In fact, Democrats, who were the out party in 2018, won independents by 15 points. So you would have expected, going by historical data, that Republicans would have won, Republicans as the out party, would have won independents in 2022 by 15 points. Instead, they lost them by two. Why did they lose them by two? Abortion and Trump, two things that the party is ever more centered around as it goes into this next presidential race. So that data came out this week from the Pew Research Center.
Maren, what's your chatter?
I'm going to bring this into the sort of more mid to low brow portion of the cocktail chatter. I want to talk about the Tour de France, which I have been obsessed with. I don't know. Are either of you watching it?
You're stealing my chatter.
Oh, no. I stole your chatter?
God. Go ahead. Bring it. We'll just share our chatter.
I'm sorry, but I'm obsessed. It's the only non-car thing I want to talk about, I think, forever. I watched that Netflix documentary like 2 weeks before the tour started and just kind of became obsessed with all of these figures and am having so much fun watching it every morning. It's been so exciting this year.
What? No Wimbledon?
No Wimbledon. Not this year.
One of the things I did on vacation with my kids is we watched Tour de France Unchained, the Netflix show. We've talked about Drive to Survive. That was the F1 show, the documentary, beautifully, beautifully shot documentary about Formula One. And this is the same thing, has now been done for golf. It's been done for tennis. And it's now been done for the Tour de France. And my God, it was so good, the 2022 Tour de France. It's so beautiful. And unlike F1, it's not, the cyclists are not loathsome. They're not kind of douchebag Euro trash prince lanes, and they're not the people who run the cycle lane are not loathsome Russian oligarchs. Cyclists they're weird, they're intense, they're both egotistical but also collegial.
They're all like 25 and weigh 130 pounds and have two children. Mm-hmm. I mean, it like is baffling to me that I think they just live these
Flemish.
Yeah, these like monastic lives where they're just cycling in the mountains of Europe every single day. But it's super fun to watch and learn the different personalities. And it's given me an appreciation for watching these races where you see how much of it is. It is about strength and stamina, certainly, but it's also very much a mind game and a strategy game. I don't know if you watched Jasper Philipsen yesterday win the stage, but the way he pulled off his final sprint, I mean, it's almost like a game of Tetris or something where you're trying to like find these openings and you have to just have killer instincts to win one of these things. And it's so cool to watch, like someone will be leading the whole time and then it won't matter because in the last like 30 seconds, someone just pops out of nowhere that you've never heard of and wins the whole thing. Oh, it's delightful.
I think the thing that I like also is that when you first start to watch it, if you have no explanation, the strategy is totally incomprehensible and you kind of don't know what's going on. But just a little bit of information makes it comprehensible. And then you are no longer an ignorant viewer, but a kind of semi-knowledgeable viewer. And that is really fun.
I do think you have to watch the documentary first, though, right?
Yes.
Because otherwise you won't know who these people are. I mean, it's great because it sort of gives you these portraits of the people who are sort of the people that you want to watch in this year's tour. So like you get like a little bit of story and background about them, and then you can sort of root for them this year.
Listeners, you have also sent us chatters. Please keep them coming to us. You should tweet them at us. I guess you could thread them to it. We're not on thread, so don't thread them to us yet. But maybe one day you can thread your chatter to us. But best of all, email them to us at gabfest@slate.com, something you're talking about at your cocktail party. And this week's listener chatter comes from Dan Kirkwood.
Hey, this is Dan Kirkwood in Juneau, Alaska. Last week, kids in Angoon, Alaska launched a 30-foot-long hand-carved red cedar canoe, the first traditional dugout canoe carved there since the U.S. Navy bombardment that destroyed the village. Back in the fall of 1882, the U.S. Navy destroyed the homes, food stores, and dugout canoes used to hunt, fish, and gather food. Many people starved to death that winter. Only one canoe survived the bombing, and it became both a vehicle and a symbol of the village's survival. The new boat went into the water after a naming ceremony. The kids paddled the canoe in their traditional regalia in front of the whole community. The name that the kids chose for the boat translates to unity. The community is still seeking an apology for the bombing, and this made me think of the David Plotz rule for apologies, that a good apology should be absolute.
I do think that about apologies. Unconditional. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Julie Hugan. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio of Slate. Please Email us your chatter at gabfest@slate.com. For Maren Kogan, so great having you. Definitely you should come back again and again.
Oh, thank you. Anytime. So fun.
And John Dickerson and David Plotz, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? How you doing? Maren, you do have the best beat in the world with transportation and its woes. And we were talking about what to do about Slate Plus, and you mentioned you're working on a piece about how traffic enforcement is fundamentally broken. I really want to talk about this because I'm obsessed with all the ways in which it feels shitty to drive in my city, Washington, D.C., and all the ways in which people are abusing systems, but also recognizing that the traffic enforcement is also very bad for a certain class of people. So start spitting some wisdom here.
Yeah. So I'm obsessed with this too, having, you know, lived in DC for many years and having noticed how crazy it's gotten. I mean, I can't remember if I told you guys this last time, but my home office sits over a four-way stop. And so a big part of why I started writing about this is just that I noticed in 2020 that cars were just flying through the four-way stop. And now that is the norm rather than the exception. Like, no one stops at the stop signs anymore. And thinking about why that is, and it's like, well, it's because people are behaving rationally with the understanding that nothing will happen if they violate traffic laws. So this is something I'm sure you guys have seen it. People just plowing through red lights, not bothering to slow down, behaving really recklessly, driving really recklessly. That's been sort of a big coverage focus of mine. But then just starting to think about how can we do this better? Because I started digging into the traffic enforcement that we have system that we've had in this country for many years, and it's terrible. It's disproportionately impacting Black and brown communities. It really unfairly punishes the poor. We have this system now where if you get a speeding ticket and you're like a rich person, you can just sort of pay it and go on with your life, and maybe your behavior won't be deterred because it wasn't that much money. Or if you are poor and you don't have the money to pay, you could end up with escalating debt. You could even end up in prison for not being able to pay that debt, right? And it doesn't really help people if they don't have the money to pay. They don't have the money to pay, right? And you have to do really horrible things to people to punish them for the fact that they don't have any money to pay. So, terrible system that we have now, and it's the thing that has, you know, led to a lot of these incidents of police brutality that have gone viral and that we've seen in the news. So there's been a lot of focus on reforming some of these practices. On the other hand, we seem to have this this new system or lack of system that has emerged where it's just like, I think it seems that police have largely given up in certain places on enforcing anything. And so drivers are reacting to that new reality where you can do basically whatever you want. So I feel like there has to be something in between these two systems. One is unfairly punitive, and it's over things like broken tail lights or an expired license or something like that. And one where we're just not helping address safety issues at all. And it's something that would be between that would be actually just focusing on safety. So people who are driving really, really fast, people who are driving really recklessly, people who are driving under the influence like David in Scotland, just really focusing... focusing on the bad actors like David and just really making sure we get them off the road. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, that's the thing I've been thinking about. And you've seen these crashes that happen where you're like, how did this get to this point? Like, we got to do this better and smarter and more equitably.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s,
cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotarucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.